Deborah, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right. We have Deborah Granick on the air, and you're talking to me. I'm Tom, and to my right is Ellen, and to her right is Jake, the intern.
Hey,
Deborah.
Hey,
now, I happen to have seen your two feature films, and I've seen the film that sort of started off. What was it called? Snake Feed.
Oh, yeah. A lot of years ago.
Yeah. And then that turned into Down to the Bone.
Right.
Sort of. Which had the lovely Vera Farmiga in it, playing a drug addict. And then, of course, Winter's Bone. And young Jake here was quite thrilled when he realized that Jennifer Lawrence was in that film.
Oh, absolutely.
And before we talk about the film that you're coming to town with, we just want to talk about these a little bit. Because in both of those feature fiction films, you really found two incredible talents before they really, became better known.
Yeah, well, that, some of that serendipity, I think that people become known after they get a chance to do a kind of what we call a fleshed out role, a role where you get to see various aspects of how they interpret a character, and especially if the character's written with a lot of aspects. So it's not so, there's no real, special power or magic in that. It's really about the idea of whole people, and then once an audience or viewers get a taste for that, they definitely want to see more. They get a deeper impression of the actor.
And in fact, Jennifer
sort of
Lawrence.
What's their appetite?
Yeah. With John, wasn't John Hawkes also nominated for an award for Winner's Bone?
Yeah, and he, he was in that sense, maybe it was just a role that went against type for him, and therefore he got to show a whole other set of facets. And I think people also, they just enjoy that. They enjoy seeing an actor, take some risks and go into new material. I think people are actually really supportive of that.
I'm a huge fan of Daniel Woodrell. How did you come upon his novel? Over
the
screen.
His novel at the time, he's prolific, and
mm-hmm.
his novel was out in the world circulating, and it was there for, he was, I think, an author who, he is an author who, makes it clear that he's open to adaptation for screenplay to screen, and when my producing partner and I read the novel, it was very much a page-turner, it was very concise,
mm-hmm.
and it was extremely atmospheric, it was regional, so it had all these ingredients that made us feel like, what an attractive American story to tell of different contemporary works that are out there. And it ended up being also quite feasible. It didn't need a lot of special effects to make this film go. It was an older tale, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And other than Lawrence and Hawks, most of the actors were just locals that you found, right? Or a good percentage of them.
Yeah, they were the local community, what ended up being a very big resource for that film. We needed those faces. We needed the accents, the ways of speaking to mix in with the professional actors, to just ground the piece in its exact coordinates. And many of those people were also sort of advisors behind the scenes as well. They were people who were giving very precise details about how to do something, how to
mm-hmm.
skin a squirrel, or what the house should look like, or actually allowing us to film in real homes. So they were truly the local authorities that were giving the precision to what you see on screen.
And with both feature films, these were not in any sense autobiographical. You're from, I think I read Cambridge?
East Coast. Yeah.
And, so these are kind of much grittier, I imagine, than anything in your own life.
Right. They are definitely stories that are told in a very different part of the country, under very different life circumstances, absolutely. And that makes, I think there are two sides to that, or there are many sides, but two that stand out to me. One is that you are having to use a lot of techniques that people refer to as visual anthropology. It's not a world you know, so therefore it requires a lot of observation, a lot of, almost take mental notes, photographic notes, and asking people to be the guide to a life that you don't know. And so therefore, it also makes you see quite sharply, things that maybe some people take for granted when they're living the life as an outsider. You know, it's all very new to you, so therefore there is that almost like compiling of notes. It's not to say like that it's a special position. It's more that things are of great interest because they're unfamiliar.
Right. I think what happens in both movies is that there's not the slightest note of any kind of condescension towards the characters. I mean, they really are allowed to kind of develop on their own in a kind of organic way that seems totally true. Especially, I remember the ending to Down to the Bone, thinking, I mean, that was brilliant. It was so unlike a Hollywood movie. And how she behaves with that final scene where she rejects him. Of course, our listeners probably have no idea what I'm talking about, which means we should probably start talking about how you came to then now do... I know you've done other documentary work in the past?
I have, usually in service to other people's films, you know, working with someone who had a project that I was able to join in on as a... in the previous times, as a photographer.
Was that your... pre-film background in photography?
Videography, you know.
Right.
The sense of, you know, it's always been really, in terms of professional work, moving images, but the fact is, I really kind of came into the scene on the cheap end of things, you know, in the video world, you know, just the accessible, inexpensive camera world that became, you know, larger, and then, of course, has now graduated into, like, the fine camera world. You know, it's gone from the funky to the fine, which is good for the whole democracy of it all. But, yeah, so that I have a background in shooting a lot of nonfiction material, more on the educational side of things in a previous kind of day job situation. But this shooting a documentary this time around was truly an outgrowth of Winter's Bone. You know, I did end up meeting everyone who's in this documentary from working on that fictional project.
And the subject of Stray Dogs is?
It's a family in southern Missouri, helmed by a man who goes by the biker name Stray Dog. His name is Ron Hall, and it's really a look at his particular slice of American experience, where he came of age, what decade, where it was, which was Vietnam, and what the ensuing decades, his observations about how that marked his life and his generation, and now... Where does he go from there, you know, and where does he go from here? So it's really just a slice of life, of contemporary American life in the heartland, as sort of told and shown by this one guide, if you will, Stray Dog.
Sort of an antidote to the Sons of Anarchy idea?
I think it is, because, you know, Sons of Anarchy is one iteration of biker culture, and you come to find out it is such a broad culture. It has, you know, if you want to use the metaphor of a spectrum, you know, it goes from the tinkerers and people who, you know, want to try it or experiment, or weekend warriors, to social kind of clubs, to the what we know is the sort of tougher, more badass side of biker culture, which involved MCs and kind of outlaw biker culture. So it runs this full spectrum, and within a lot of places on that spectrum are veterans from each one of our wars. And it's been, I think, one thing that Ron, in conversing with Ron over the years, that came to light was that there's just been this long history since World War II of veterans and biker culture interlacing. And people give very plausible and interesting theories about why this is. And the film doesn't really trace that history as much as just kind of try to show glimpses of that. I mean, it's active. They're on the bikes. They're doing it. Yeah.
Did you ever see a documentary called Burt's Bikers?
Did I see that?
Yeah.
I have not seen that.
It's about bikers in Port Chester, New York, who do a sort of outreach to disabled children. It was made by Roy Frumkes, who teaches at SVA, I believe. Anyway.
Oh, I'd like to add that to my viewing list.
Yeah, I was just curious when I saw what yours was about. When I wondered if you'd seen that sort of a, it's. I don't think it's quite as gritty or as, you know, in the same way, but.
But it does probably dispel that not every not all people who get involved in biking are running crime syndicates. You know, it's not all about being badder than bad. You know, there's a lot of, and a lot of bikers who've experienced that earlier in their lives actually do transition into what they call, you know, maybe just wind therapy, where you just feel so, that it's so therapeutic and important in your life to just get on the bikes with some brothers, maybe some sisters, you know, and actually just try to be out as a bonded group, you know, for no greater gain than to have a decent Saturday, you know, in your life, you know, just in the here and now with the money that you can afford for gas, just have a good Saturday or a good Thursday, you know. So there's some very poignant, relevant themes that come up that you wouldn't necessarily expect to be linked to biker culture.
So after the success of Winner's Bone, did you, were you tempted to, I mean, were there offers to do sort of mainstream Hollywood projects, or did you resist that? I mean, what happened?
There's some offers, you know, but those offers are just usually, they come, I feel like, with this big ball and chain, and they kind of limp across your, you know, they limp over to your office, or, you know, and then you realize that there is really a lot of just, I would call structural weight that is attached to sort of some West Coast productions that hasn't proven to be too scintillating to me personally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that being said, you know, there are many topics that I do care about deeply that have been hard to get off the ground. So, you know, it's not that, you know, I have vast interests and I try to be very picky about what I apply myself to because the projects take a very long time to make.
Mm-hmm. Are the economics of a documentary a lot simpler than a feature film?
At least getting into it, yes. Embroiled, yes. You, for many documentaries, you do not need to necessarily fundraise the whole thing before you start. You have so many less salaries, so many less promissory notes, if you will, you know, so much less that you are owing people at the beginning. So therefore, you can even, you know, many people make documentaries in increments so that you're really going in small, affordable patches. You know, and the big balloon payment is always the post-production. That's always the big price tag at the end. But starting out, there's really nothing that can stop you from starting a documentary, except not getting the permission from the subjects themselves. You know,
yeah.
or you know, you can imagine some topics are so hot that they involve a lot of personal risk to make them, such as the things that we're seeing coming out now that deal with very, very, I don't know what you call them. I mean, kind of risky topics about national security, about American policy. You know, those documentaries, I could never say those are just easy to start. Those take a whole mess of resources, not just financial, but...
And personal risks.
Yes, personal risks.
We had, on Democracy Now!, there was a documentarian this morning talking about her new film about the NSA, and, you know, you can imagine the difficulties of making a film about that.
Yeah, and that's the film that, you know, right now probably is a real game changer in terms of showing, you know, the deep interest in viewers to see documents like that that try to shed light on a period of recent history that's been very confounding and very troubling.
Well, one of the interesting points the documentarian made, I can't remember her name, was that once Edward Snowden went public with documents, other whistleblowers were willing to be in her film because now they felt, you know, justified for one thing, and it made her job a lot easier. Now, when you were working with bikers, I mean, did you have to build up a certain trust before you could get very far into the project?
Most definitely, and I think, you know, if Ron hadn't been sort of, he knew us a little bit from, he'd appeared in the fictional project in Winter's Bone. He had a role in that film, and I think he was willing to stand for us. I think he was willing to hear us out, see how the first couple shoots went, and then he was willing to tell his friends what we were doing, explain us to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it makes a huge, it's kind of invaluable. It's the crux. You know, if he had some trust and faith in us, then it was easy for him to then put his neck out and say, hey, my friends will appear in this. You know, we're pretty sure that you're not going to just misconstrue us and, you know, sort of somehow betray us, like get us to be in this and then throw us under the bus. That I think he could sense where we were going with this project. But without him introducing us and paving the way, I could not see any kind of access. What's an East Coast person with a camera, how far are you going to get? Mm-hmm. Not very far.
The question I always have for a documentarian is, after it's over, how did the subjects feel about what you did with all that information and time and film that you took?
I mean, that is the huge ethical weight of documentary making. That's why that first screening, when you do show it to the people that gave their time and participated and gave you some trust, is the most, that's the most unnerving screening. That's the screening that you absolutely don't feel like you can breathe through until you hear them feel like they're okay, you know, that they said they kind of sign off on it. And, you know, in this case, we were fortunate. I mean, it's a positive portrait. I mean, Ron, this is unabashedly a positive portrait of someone. This is a portrait of a person who's earnestly trying to find the meaning in his life and live in a way, as he would say, so he doesn't harm himself or others, you know, and that takes a lot of restraint and a lot of effort. And, you know, Ron, I think, felt like the film is in service. He feels like his participation was in service. One of the things he got out of it was that it meant a lot to him to be able to speak to other vets about the role of therapy, for PTSD. And he's not evangelical about it, but yet it gives him a sense of fulfillment to be able to find what he calls a brother, another veteran who he feels could truly benefit from both compassionate and informed therapy, basically therapy that is given by other combat veterans. And, you know, so Ron feels that he has a very legitimate motivation for participating in the film. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes him feel pretty good. You know, that's a kind of work that, or it's in service to something that he feels was worthwhile. And that, you know, I think in some sense that's good enough for all of us. It's like, mm-hmm. once he said that, I felt pretty relieved. I felt like, you know, he feels like there was some worth in this, or a lot of worth in it. Mm-hmm.
So are you taking the film to other festivals, or is it going to go into general release, or what's the future of the film?
Docs always have a circuitous path. I mean, the festival life has been pretty robust, and that's been a big blessing on the film. You know, we almost put on the poster for this film a saying that Ron, when he first realized that after we'd worked on this, that it would actually be a public document. You know, I mean, he knew that, but mm-hmm. it was just when it really came to be finished. We showed him a proof for the poster, and he's like, you know, I was looking for kind of maybe a saying to put on it, and he's like, you know, girl, I ain't everyone's cup of tea, you know, I know that, and, you know, that's been a mantra that, you know, has been in my head, and it really is, it's really true for this film. It's not everyone's cup of tea, and yet, for those who take a shine or get something out of it, there's been very hearty support, and that's given the film a life, and that's been, you know, it's beyond a blessing. It's like you need mm-hmm. that. You need that for a film to circulate. And it looks like we may be very fortunate and have a PBS broadcast for this film.
Yeah.
Which would be...
That'd be great,
a truly efficient way to sort of have some of this material be out there for public, you know, ingestion or interest. And with any kind of... with theatrical... only a very few docs really can make it into that world, and we're still sort of waiting to see. We know that there's some local theaters that are interested in showing it, and that, again, it might find its audience that way. And then the last kind of arena for distribution would be these specific audience kinds of distribution, which are growing now. They go by the name of Gather or Sprout, or they have, there's a couple, you know, I mean, they're almost like companies that know how to target very specific. They would know how to do outreach in the veteran community. They would know how to do outreach in the families of the veteran community. And that might be a very appropriate and good home for this film.
It says here, this is Ellen speaking. It's not,
hello there.
It's not Tom's voice. it was shown, the film was shown in New York and Los Angeles already, the film festivals there. How was it received there?
Well, Los Angeles was its launch, and we had a real champion there. one of the programmers, it was her cup of tea, and she just did a beautiful job putting the film out in front of audiences and hooking us up with some journalists who took an interest in it. So I think it was a very good reception. And then very recently, 2 weeks ago, it was the New York Film Festival. And there, too, I feel like Ron was able to come to New York for that, and it was a really big kind of pilgrimage for him, actually. You know, he hadn't really been in a mega city in a long time. And
Did he take questions from the audience, or was
he did. He
oh,
did,
wow.
And it was quite a rich Q&A, mm-hmm. and for whatever reason, we were blessed with the fact that we could be in the theater for a minute, so we actually could have an extended conversation with the audience who was there that evening. That was a very positive experience. And then the film's going to have a pretty hefty run in Europe this fall. And that's going to be very interesting to hear another perspective. I mean, on one level, we had heard that a lot of compassionate Europeans were really exhausted by our 15 years of war making. You know, they just couldn't see another film about Afghanistan or Iraq or what, you know, it's that incredulity. Like, what are you all doing? You know, you're wrecking your country. You're dying. What are you doing? And they just couldn't see any more films on it. And I think the fact is that this film somehow, because it's a different generation speaking, it kind of sheds light on the whole picture. And I, for whatever reason, it's gained some traction there and seems to be of interest. Will be an interesting perspective, however.
I think one point might be that, unlike after the Vietnam War, where people were sort of pushed veterans out of the picture because they were so embarrassed by the whole thing, I think we're far more receptive to helping the veterans who are coming back from our current adventures abroad. I mean, you're probably not old enough to remember the Vietnam vets when they came back and how people just shunned them, really.
Yeah, no, that is, it's like a wound that was a social wound that just did not heal properly. It stayed as an infection, and it's like, That is the one ripping thing I learned from, searing thing I learned from this process, which is that certain kinds of social abnegation, rejection, that stays in a generation for a very, in a demographic for a very long time. And I think, the suicide rate from the men that did serve in Vietnam but then came home, and you know, is such a confounding figure. It's still one of these ongoing, it's sort of the infection's still there, and that statistic is there to kind of haunt us. And yet these veterans are speaking to the themes that the veterans, our contemporary vets, are still to face. You know, the PTSD has a lifespan that far exceeds what people expect. People think, a couple years and you're done with this particular, set of huge psychiatric, weight. And it's not exactly how it goes for many vets, for many combat veterans. It's a far more extensive process. Often appears to take up a very large piece of their adult life.
Well, I hate to cut you off like that, but we only have a minute left, and I want Ellen to tell everybody in our audience where they can see this film this weekend.
They can see the film here in Hudson. For the first time, the film festival is showing some, putting some programs here in Hudson at the Hudson Lodge at 601 South Union Street. And you can see Stray Dog at 3 o'clock on Saturday. We've been talking, of course, with Deborah Granick, the filmmaker, and she will be present at the screening. And will you be answering questions afterwards? Is that the...
Actually, I will not be present. No, I don't want to set up any bad expectations.
Yep. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
I would love
to be there. I was in Woodstock last weekend, and I would love to come back up and see even the last two leaves that are left, I would love to be there, but there may be, I don't know, I have to check with the organizers to see if there's any Skype option on that, but I also wanted to add one thing just to not scare people. The film has a lot of humor. We didn't get that out in this conversation, but I just want to put that out there because it also has a huge amount of slice of life humor of just Ron in the here and now dealing with friends and family and unexpected romance that happens. So I just want to make sure that people understand that there's also some very engaging levity in the film.
Oh, great.
Just to leave it on that note, you know.
And the you can get tickets at filmcolumbia.org online. Looking forward to it. Deborah, thank you so much for calling in.
Yes, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for the time and the interest. I appreciate it.